You're listening to the Petapixel Podcast. Catch new episodes every week on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hey everybody, it's a Petapixel Podcast party, and I am here with my good friend, Chris Nichols. Say hi, Chris.
We're back! We're back after a week hiatus.
And who's that beside him? Oh man, it's my other good friend, Jaron Schneider, back from adventures in the Far East.
we were back from adventures in the old school West.
Undisclosed locations going on our own adventures. We cannot talk about this week. So it's going to be a very Jaron-centric issue. But
oh boy.
You know, with this podcast, it might be some people's first episode. And I just really want them to get a sense of who we are if they haven't already watched the show or encountered Jaron. So guys, we did the worst podcast ever. Theoretically, we are sentenced federally to death. What is your last meal?
Oh, I don't know. Dang it. I wish I had some heads up. I have no idea. Come back to me. I don't know.
Okay.
Mine would be some sort of take on sushi, although I don't think that I would want it to be a traditional just like sushi. My mouth is watering just thinking about eating sushi. While I was in Japan, I had a bowl of like tuna cuts on seasoned rice, and that was probably one of my favorite things I've ever eaten. So maybe that, something like that. That sounds like really good. I'd sit there and enjoy it as I ponder how a podcast, regardless of quality, ended up in my death sentence. Yeah.
I mean, it is an unfortunate law and a weird one for sure. Yeah. You know, I was waffling. I was like, am I going to do like a roasted lamb or am I going to do Indian?
You do love lamb.
I love lamb. Guys, I am going to hit the middle ground. I'm having lamb vindaloo, just like the hottest possible. I'm like, I want to experience every sensation before I stop. So, yeah, I'm going to go with the hottest lamb vindaloo, just mouth on fire, tears. And then I'm like, make it end. And then the whole thing will be much less emotionally traumatizing.
So your
last
meal
my strategy.
Choice, your last meal choice is going to be the same thing that like every British football fan wants after they're, you know, drunk at a game. That's your last meal.
Is that what they want?
Oh yeah. Beef and lamb vindaloo after the footy? Absolutely.
The footy.
Yeah.
I do want to say at a recent event, we were seated with the Brits and the Aussies. So we have a huge amount of insight into their culture and interests now that we can bring to the pod, Jaron.
I spent a significant amount of time with Richard Butler from DP Review. Does that help? I mean, he's basically
he's
an American now.
British. Yes, he's
quintessentially British. Yeah, we can text him and see if Chris's statement is correct. So,
all right, Chris, you've had enough time to think. You have to give it.
Yes, I appreciate you giving me the time. So I would say I would go with like a comfort food, you know, something that will like just relax me.
Natto?
Natto is disgusting. You're the only person, you and my mom are the only people on the planet that would eat what smells the same
that
going
is the
into
death
your
sentence.
Body as it does coming out.
It smells like paint thinner. Anyway, what is an actual
then
comfort
you poop
food
paint you thinner.
I think it's a comfort food.
Anyways, I would go with chicken pot pie, classic, hearty chicken pot pie, just, you know, comfort food, relax, you know, and then hopefully die while still eating it. That would be nice.
Okay.
Poisoned chicken pot pie.
Okay.
I think this was a great intro. We all did an awesome job, and we should watch the opening cartoon now.
Your intros.
Thanks to OM System for sponsoring this episode of the Petapixel Podcast. OM System recently unveiled its latest flagship camera, the OM-1 Mark II, on January 30th, building upon the legacy of the original OM-1. With double the buffer size and impressive high-speed sequential shooting capabilities, up to 50 frames per second with continuous autofocus, the new camera offers enhanced AF performance, accuracy, and reliability. Anticipated to begin shipping any day now, insider information from OM System reveals that they extended their pre-order promotion. Originally expected to conclude on February 26, it is now extended until the end of March. Pre-order your OM1 Mark II body or kit by March 31st and enjoy an additional complimentary BLX1 battery. Bundle your purchase with select lenses to save up to $300. Visit explore.omsystem.com/petapixel for more details. Thanks.
Thanks, OM.
Thanks again to OM System for sponsoring the Petapixel podcast. We really appreciate it. We're going to talk a little bit more about OM actually today in the, so for those who are used to the way we typically do our podcast, we'll do like a couple news stories and then we'll have a main segment and then we'll move on. There was so much that happened in the last week that we have no time for a main segment. The main segment is the news.
Let's dive in.
We're going to get through all of it. So that when I mentioned we'll talk about OM more this episode, that's because there's some OM stuff in here as well. But let's...
I think everyone dropped hot news, right? Is there anyone who didn't?
Hot
scoops.
Canon and Nikon were both kind of quiet. I don't think they had anything to say at CP Plus. This is what this is all about, by the way, for anyone curious why this past week was so busy. There's a Japanese trade show called CP Plus. It takes place in Yokohama, Japan.
It's huge.
It is the biggest remaining global trade show for photography, and it is not huge. It is very small.
No, everybody says it's huge.
I walked the entire trade show in, I don't know, less than 6 minutes. You could do a whole full circle.
Oh, wow.
It's very small. But, you know, the big players, they all have the big booths. Sony's booth was gigantic. I think that's the largest one I've ever seen from them.
Wow.
Canon's was really big. Nikon's was really big. But
it was the Photokina days where Fuji's you would have really to like big. Actually sleep in a display. Overnight.
You'd have to be fit to do Photokina, now you can just kind of like shuffle, it sounds like. I do want to say, like, big ups to CP Plus, because we had our best day on YouTube since joining Petapixel was first day of that show. So, yay, CP Plus.
Well, let's first, before that, I cannot let us go any further in this conversation without getting Jordan to talk about the Canon 24-105 f/2.8, because the listeners are very upset that you did not get on camera and talk about this lens for videography, because it's a videographer's lens, really.
Oh, geez.
You made Chris talk about it. They want to hear Jordan's words out of Jordan's mouth. So go.
Okay. So first of all,
they'll be the same words.
So, yeah, Chris and I do actually discuss things before he doesn't just like show up and I'm like, go. Like, there is a back and forth with both of us. And I did actually shoot some video with this, took it out to a BMX competition, like a big air show. And it was great. The reason I didn't go too far into it is, first of all, we did not have access to the servo mechanism, which is a big part of what makes this, you know, such an enticing option for videographers. But outside of that, you know, Chris can speak to the breathing side of things. I do find it absolutely baffling that the iris ring only works for video shooters.
Isn't that weird?
It is very odd. Like, just the disconnect of looking down at your lens and it's like at 2.8 and you look at your camera body and you're shooting at f/16 is very odd.
There has to be a way for them to fix that, like firmware update it to let that happen.
Yeah, I mean, but the aperture, you can't have click stops, which, I mean, I don't think many photographers would care that much, but it's obviously purpose-built from the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, it is truly a hybrid lens, but doesn't have some of the stuff that we might expect with, like, a cinema lens. Like, it is electronically parfocal, which looks kind of odd. If you do like a snap zoom, you'll see the focus drift, because it does breathe a little bit too. You'll see the edges of the frame move a little as it compensates for that. We've seen similar things on, like, did you ever see the giant Sony 28-135, Jaron, that was kitted with like the FS700 and stuff like that? Okay. Very similar kind of look to it there. But it was an excellent video lens, like shooting that kind of stuff where we've got subjects moving very quickly and, you know, erratically towards the camera. The autofocus on the lens did a great job keeping up. Actually, the R5 was more the one that was struggling to keep up when someone jumped right into the frame, had a few issues. But the lens itself does perform wonderfully as a video lens. We just didn't go too far down that in our full review because we didn't have access to the most important aspect that makes it such a good video lens, which is that servo mechanism. But yeah, that's my thoughts on it. It's a great video lens.
Okay.
Well, we did it.
You did it. There was no we in there. It was all you. All right. Well, let's now move on back to the CP Plus conversation and then the fact that it was a really big week for us on YouTube. And the main reason for that would be Fujifilm and the X106, which I have right here.
I want it. Gimme.
You had it for a day.
You did have it.
It was not long enough.
I hand-delivered this to you, and then I hand-delivered it back to myself.
And then you took it away like a monster. Right.
So let's recap here. The Fujifilm X106 was announced at, I think it was a $200 price premium over the X105. But that was no inhibition on people's interest. It is probably our most viewed video in the first 24 hours that we've done. How does it compare to like videos you've done in the past?
Well, this is easily one of the biggest launch day videos. Yeah.
Although it's funny because one of the biggest videos that we ever did with DP Review before was the X100V.
The biggest.
Yeah, it's the best. So yeah, it's funny that people have a real hard on for this camera. They really love it. And I thought it was fine.
It's because you don't like 35 millimeter.
Well, that's, you know what I think it is. So here's the thing. When we did the X100V, never really enjoyed the original X100s, you know, the T's, the F's. I mean, they were fine. I get it, but I didn't love them. And then the V was the first one where I was like, oh, I like the changes. I like the handling. I like the new image quality. This is a good camera. I like using it. So much so that it was like a surprise. So I think I talked it up a lot because I was really quite enjoyably surprised by this new camera. And then the X106 came out and it's fine because it's basically an X105 with some updates. And I think the updates are great. The IBIS is fantastic. The new sensor is great, but it just isn't going to inspire the same joy because it's like, otherwise it's an X105. I've already had that excitement. That excitement's gone and had babies and died. So, you know, now it's like
only a 4-year lifespan.
Yeah. It's like an insect. It's like a very quick kind of thing. And so it's a nice camera. I think it's fantastic. I think it makes a lot of sense for photographers. I think a lot of people enjoy it. Hopefully they'll be able to produce more now that's made in China, but yeah, it's a good camera. But Jaron, you can hold on to it as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, this is mine now. I love this camera. So I did not get to experience the V. In fact, this is my first X100. I have very limited experience with Fujifilm in general. I have never used a GFX camera. I have used some of the XT series, but I holding this the second it came out of the box, I'm like, this is it. This is what I want. And I think some people have, so there's like a mixed reaction to this. There's folks who say that it's awesome. It's whatever it's trend and it's trendy because people seem to really like it. And I think it really comes down to the film simulations that are built in. I think that is a huge advantage for Fujifilm because you can create art with this thing straight out of camera. And it also shoots to HEIFs now direct.
We're heifing it.
Which is really nice. But then whenever you have anything popular, it is just as popular, I argue, to be anti that. So it's like, if you don't feel love for this and decide that you want to be trendy still, you will now then start hating on this thing online. That's the way
world we live
it.
In, Jared.
You have to pick one or the other.
There is no middle ground with this camera online, it seems.
Which is, to me, very silly. Like, if you don't like something, move on. You don't need to sit here and like hate
on it. I
mean,
I want to argue that I represent the middle ground on this camera, and I believe you guys chastised me for that.
When did I do that?
I'm just saying.
I did. That was me being like, what don't you love about this thing? It's perfect. I love this camera.
I'm like, it's fine. But
I'm a 35 junkie too.
Yeah, so. I also love 35. Chris is the minority here.
Yes.
When I was using this thing, I just felt happy. I think there are very few, I've expressed this on the podcast before. There are very few cameras that make me excited to go take pictures. Like I'm very much burned out on taking pictures. I just enjoy things with my regular human eyes as opposed to looking through a viewfinder these days. But using this, I was like, I feel like taking a picture. I feel like making art for myself. And that's the thing too. I make art for me. I don't care what other people think. I'll print my own pictures and put them on my own wall. I don't need to impress anyone else with my work. And I don't care if they like it or not. Yes, Chris needs to impress people with his work.
Yes, it's my job.
I do want to throw out one thing that I wasn't expecting that no one's really talking about that I loved with that camera. Everybody forgets it is a hybrid optical electronic viewfinder. Most people wind up, I think, just using it as an electronic viewfinder the vast majority of the time. It's more practical and everything. But I had a great time using the optical viewfinder combined with the new tracking algorithm because I have never used an optical viewfinder that'll track an object right to the edges of the frame. So my daughter's just running around. And that's a very cool, you know, very connected experience, but where I'm not constantly fighting with the limitations of an optical, you know, where I got to keep my subject right in the middle of the frame or whatever. I really enjoyed that shooting experience. And
but being
I
the
do
centrist
think,
that I am,
yes,
you didn't love the video, which makes sense. It's not a great sensor for it.
That's the exact limitation. I was shocked at how good the X100-5 was as a video camera. Like I looked silly with, you know, a 2.5 millimeter to 3.5 millimeter adapter beside a USB to 3.5 millimeter adapter dangling off this itty bitty camera on a monopod when I filmed that episode.
But
the shooting experience and the quality was fantastic. Yeah. And this camera, yeah, it's a sensor that is a little slower to read out. There are more compromises with it compared to the other one, but you've got, you know, the better video profiles on it. You have tap to track, which is going to make it a lot more usable for just like, you know, the kind of stuff this camera is for, yeah, just quickly capturing little moments. So it's going to be tough. I want to spend more time with the camera to say like definitively, you know, is the 5 or the 6 the better video camera? And that's why we will do a long-term review of this,
yeah,
when Jaron sends this camera up and we don't give it back so, to him and we keep it forever.
This one that I'm holding here will not go back to you. This,
no!
This, you will get your own sent. This is not technically a production body.
That's true.
So this is a pre-production body, even though it is now running 1.0 firmware. We are going to wait for, I think, the first firmware update after this comes out, and then you guys will get it to do your review, and you can spend your time with it. I will write the review, though, because I feel very strongly about this camera. There were a couple questions I wanted to answer about this that I've seen on YouTube. One of them was like, how's the lens performing with the sensor? Great.
Beautifully.
Yeah.
No, yeah. Problem. No problems at all. Yeah.
Sharpie, sharp, sharp, sharp.
I will say, how is it performing with the autofocus? I will reduce that from great to good. I think I haven't had problems with it, like getting what I want it to get. Like if I'm pointed at something and I want that to be the point of focus, it's getting it. But I won't say that this lens is fast. It's fine.
Right.
I brought it to that same BMX competition, and when things are very quickly moving towards it, like the autofocus is tracking it, the box is on the subject, it's just the lens can't move fast enough.
But yeah, I think that is the limitation. That is an unusual use case for this camera.
One's shooting BMX with an X106.
And they shouldn't, yeah.
No, that's a lunatic's game.
I'm very curious to see what happens with this camera. You know, the X100-5 had such... a huge following, became incredibly popular. And I wonder if that's because it was so hard to get. Like it really was a classic example of basic economic supply and demand where people just started to really pine for this camera more so when it was difficult to get. I mean, people liked it when it was available, but when it really started to take off, it had already been on the market for a while and people just started to love it and they could not keep up with demand. And I wonder, like objectively, the 6 is a better camera in pretty much every way, shape, and form except video. Yeah. And so I wonder, though, if the same draw is going to be there, considering that the, you know, technically the 6 should have, well, technically, I'm assuming, should have an easier time with production. So I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. A couple of things on that. So first, as far as like pre-orders go, I do know that Amazon sold out of their pre-order allotment and that Amazon is run by Fujifilm. So it's a Fujifilm store. So they sold all on Amazon in the US, however many they were going to do. I know that some other dealers have reached their allotment number. Moment, who makes lenses for smartphones, they also have a shop. I don't know if you guys even knew that. You could buy stuff that's not made by Moment there. They have the X106 for sale. Like you can pre-order it through them. And I think that might be a very good option to do because they're not as popular as like a B&H or an Adorama. And they do have an allotment. Now, I don't know how their shipping is going to work. They come in like, I'm assuming that they come in waves. Like everyone gets a certain amount and they have to ship them out whenever. But I don't think that this will be that hard to get. But that said, I have seen people try to sell these already for like $2,500 or more on the secondhand market. If you're listening to this and you really want this camera, just be patient. I promise you that they will hit their allotments and this will become readily available. So like it's worth waiting and not spending the extra money. Finally, there's one last note I wanted to make before we move on, and it's the IBIS. Some folks are like, I don't need IBIS in this camera.
Why not?
Madness.
I will argue that it opens up a way to shoot that I couldn't shoot with this before. Even though I didn't use the X100V, I know that I wouldn't be able to get these shots because I have shaky coffee hands. So I did a couple long exposures handheld during the middle of the day to get like motion of people. And that kind of shot for like street photography, I love. I don't like necessarily showing people's faces in street photography. I think I like the idea of people in the shots. I just don't want you to know who they are. I think that adds to like the mystique and the beauty of a street photo to think that it could be anywhere or anyone. And I like the ability to hand hold like down to one over fourth of a second or less to try and get like a nice sharp background, but like moving bodies. And then doing that at night too is working for me. Cool. So you might not need IBIS, but I think having IBIS lets you do more. And I think that is a nice addition.
What was the slowest shutter speed you think you got like a sharp result at on a 35 millimeter equivalent?
Is that 1/4 of a second? I was just thinking about this and my brain broke. Like, right. So is it, so it's 1/30 of a second, 1/15 of a second, 1/8 of a second, and 1/4 of a second. Is that 1/4 of a second?
Yeah.
I don't think it is. Yeah. Is it?
Yeah.
It is? Okay. So it's 1/4 of a second. I don't know. I started thinking about it too hard. And then it's like saying a word in English over and over again, and then it starts sounding wrong. Like I did that to myself.
I would just add though that like, even if you get the sharpest, most technically perfect image out of like your beautiful subject matter, something very compelling and emotive, it was still on a 35. So like, does it even matter? Like, is it even
okay? I'm going to take that as a cue to move on.
Is it worthwhile?
Stop it. 35 is great. Get out of here. The other thing is that in addition to the X100 VI, Fujifilm did a couple of other things that are kind of quietly less like, you know, I mean, it's hard to be louder than the X100 VI, but they announced that they are working on a new lens. It's a reimagining, I think, of an old lens, the XF 16-50 f/2.8-4.8. So that will be coming. They didn't say when. They just said that that's what it is. That's the next lens they're working on. But they are also doing firmware updates for other cameras, including bringing the new Reala Ace profile to the XH2S, the XH2, the XT5, and the XS20. So one of the questions that we had for Fujifilm going into CP Plus was, are you going to bring...
What happened to Kaizen? It's like they stopped for years. And this, it feels like what they... You know, we still get bug fixes from Fujifilm, but now we're seeing actual features added to the cameras again. And it seemed like we did a video back with DP Review where Chris was like chucking an X100V in the garbage, saying like, what happened to guys? That was a fun thumb. But it's true. Like, we weren't seeing those major feature updates. So I think that's kind of the big story of this, aside from the X100 VI, is the return of like major feature updates, like tap to track video coming to older bodies too.
Touch
is really
tracking
cool.
AF to the XH2S, the XH2, the XT5, and the XS20. And then there's a red frame indicator for recording coming to the XH2S and the XH2.
Nice. If we complain about stuff long enough, people will fix it. So there you go.
I am very curious about that new kit lens as well, because we just did our rundown of, you know, the best kit lenses of all time. And, you know, right near the top, I think it was number 2, is that legendary XF 18-55 2.8-4. I think early days of mirrorless, that lens was a big factor in Fujifilm getting so much market share, because you could be like, here's a Sony with a garbage kit lens, and here's a Fujifilm with a beautiful kit lens. Which one do you want? And a lot of people, the smart ones, went Fuji in those early days. This is going to have to be a great lens to maintain that legacy. And I'm surprised it's a little bit slower, but I'm happy that it's wider. That's great.
It should be a big year for Fujifilm, hey?
I'm getting the sense that they're going to do a lot this year. So keep an eye on this space.
Let's keep going.
Next thing to talk about, let's stop talking about Fujifilm for a little bit and let's talk about Sigma. We have a lot of Sigma things to talk about this week. So let's start with what they announced for CP Plus, which were two opposite ends of the spectrum lenses. So Chris, tell me what they are and your thoughts.
Yeah, very different ends. So one was the Sigma 15mm diagonal fisheye, f1.4, something we've never seen before on the market, full frame. And at first I was really like, okay, who is this for? Like, why do this? But really, the more that I played with it, I mean, it really shows that Sigma, I think with the 15 mil, is trying to basically show, hey, like, we're a world-class optics manufacturer. I think all that third-party stuff needs to go. Like, Sigma really is like a premier lens manufacturer.
It's very strange. And Kazuto Yamaki, the CEO of Sigma, I spoke to him, and like he agrees.
He's the best.
Yeah, he's awesome, by the way. He came in and was essentially like, we knew we weren't going to sell a lot of these. We made this for like a handful of very specific astrophotographers and those who specifically also shoot northern lights, because like you want to be able to have a faster shutter speed at night to actually get a nice picture of that. But he's like, we made this to prove that we could do it and do it better than, and as good or better than a first party camera manufacturer. And he's like, the idea of third party, that's what they are. But it's also like, we want to be a master of optics. We want to be
they're
like,
not a budget kind of, you know, you lose quality, but you save money kind of that whole thing is way in the past, way in the
past. I remember when we went to Photokina, Chris, together, you had the opportunity to interview him.
Yeah.
And he said very specifically, we want to be Zeiss. Which is really interesting, because Zeiss is really no longer producing photographic lenses.
But that idea
kind of left that market. But yeah, it's like nobody looked at a Zeiss as like a budget third-party lens option. They were just known for like incredible optics. And now Sigma is really, and honestly, all the third parties are stepping up. Like Tamron makes some of the best zooms ever made. Those Sigma Art Primes are just stunning.
And let's remember, like, high-end quality, but without like Zeiss prices. You know what I mean? Like, they really are still reasonable lenses. You know, the 15 mil. Keep in mind, you already have an excellent 14mm 1.4, which we love. And that was also made for astrophotographers, low light landscape, you know, very little coma, no sagittal astigmatism. It was really well corrected. The 15mm surprisingly does the exact same thing. Like, it's perfect for astrophotography. Quality is beautiful. Although we didn't get a chance to shoot it ourselves, the results are there. And so it is made for select few people that want the diagonal fisheye look for astrophotography. Or, I mean, I think it also has applications like we used it for doing interior architecture, doing like low light concert stuff. Some people might like it for funky stuff for weddings and events, you know, certainly video work for music videos or maybe some sports. But, you know, is this going to be a lens that people rent maybe more than buy? Probably. But if you really like that kind of curvature of the earth kind of look with a huge field of stars, I mean, this is the lens to get, and nobody else makes anything like it.
Mm-hmm. Arguably, going back to what you said about them being like a Zeiss, both of these lenses, which, by the way, I asked him, like, was it on purpose that Sigma released a 15 millimeter and a 500 millimeter on the same day? I was like, actually, no, that was by accident. The 15 was, I believe he said that was in process longer. Like, they've been working on it for a longer amount of time. It just happened to be ready at the same time as the 500.
Yeah.
Both of these lenses are not cheap, but also performant that you would expect from a first-party camera manufacturer.
Is that, 100%.
Because you really like the 500.
Yeah, the 500 is another perfect example of that. So f5.6, I mean, a lot of manufacturers now are making these slower primes. You know, 5.6 is not slow, but
not outside.
You know, it's slow, but you know, these slower primes, but the benefit is, of course, very compact, super lightweight. That 500 is so nice to carry around. And optically, it is one of the most perfect lenses that we've tested in a long time. I mean, it's got basically, I can't think of any real downsides optically. I mean, their flare is always well controlled. There's no loca. Focus is quick. I mean, the thing is insanely sharp, wide open at 5.6. You could put a teleconverter on. That's maybe the only downside, is the 5.6 aperture, of course, does cause some issues as far as what kind of converters we could put on it. You can, but you're going to lose a lot of light.
And that's L-mount only.
That's only L-mount. E-mount, you can't yet. Yeah.
The other complaint I've seen on this on E-mount is that you're limited on your frames per second too, because Sony doesn't let you do it.
It's true, but 15 frames per second is still really good, right? If it was 5 or something, I'd be really upset, but 15 is still plenty. We took it out shooting Wolf Dogs, and I mean, the lens is so sharp, like so good optically. Focus was bang on with the Sony bodies that we tested. So they made another basically perfect lens, and there's not a lot of fixed primes, you know, certainly available in those two mounts, like as much as you might find with Nikon, for example, or Canon. So I think it's a nice fit.
Yeah, I mean, that's the front runner for me right now. For it's only like February, but for lens of the year at this point, that's going to be one that I'm going to remember when we get to the end of the year for sure.
Yeah, it's not sexy, but it's so nice to carry around, and it's like optically stunning. Yeah, stunning.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Sony. because Sony did have an announcement.
Yes.
And Chris was on it. It's the 24 to 50 f/2.8G. You're just like, eh. that's the I watched your review and I read your article, and what I got from that was,
yeah, it's interesting. Like, it's, you know, no matter what you say, I think there's always this sort of aspect to reviewing gear that's hard to communicate, maybe easier on YouTube than it is. But
I think Jaron just did a great job.
Yeah, he did. No, I guess what I'm saying is this, like,
it's a lens.
As a gear reviewer, we look at specs, of course, we look at values, we look at data. Those are all important things. We evaluate image quality, that kind of stuff. But there's also just your initial impression. Like, you know, that's kind of a cool thing about photography. Your first impression is the same as if you meet a person or go for a job interview or something. I mean, picking up a piece of gear, I think every camera reviewer, and I would say honestly, any consumer, you have this experience where you touch it and sometimes there's something about it that's just inexplicable that you're like, oh, this feels right, or I just love the way it looks, or I just want to own it, I want to covet it.
Yeah,
and there's sometimes pieces of gear you pick up and you're like, meh, you know? What did you say?
He said that what you just described is an X106, and I'm laughing because I agree, but
yeah,
you don't.
Yeah.
You so, know, okay, specifically this 24 to 50, why
I picked it up and I was like, eh. And here's the thing. I will say before I go, I'll let you talk, but
no, I don't
the 24 to 50 is full featured. Like, I love the fact that you get customizable buttons, aperture rings. I mean, it's really well made and sealed. So it's just funny, though. There was something about it. I was like, why? And I think Jordan actually does like this kind of focal range, shorter, wide to normal than I do. I don't find as much use.
So I've always said, like, my jam is the ultra wide to normal lens. And this isn't quite there, you know.
So what,
like
18 to 35? 18 to 50?
So the 20 to 50 Sigma, the 17 to 50 Tamron, that's my jam, kind of right in there. Like, the 24 is just a fairly standard, you know, and I'm losing a little bit on the long end with it. The big thing for me is I just wasn't super impressed with it optically, where we've been, I think we even did it in our rundown of the year where we were ranking every manufacturer. We're like, Sony is just delivering. Like, every time we see new optic,
yeah,
like, wow, this is a new benchmark. And I was kind of surprised when we were initially briefed on it. They were like, okay, so I want to show you guys how this lens compares to the original 24 to 70 G Master, which is not a very well-regarded lens.
No, it's bad.
That's why they updated to the version 2.
Right.
So right there, I already had warning signs going off a little bit. Like,
yeah,
why don't we compare this to an optic from the last 7 years? That would be great. And yeah, we just weren't super impressed once I saw those charts, seeing some longitudinal chromatic aberration, which I'm not used to seeing from Sony glass. It's like they brought back one of the old lens designers and they were like, take another stab at it. And then, you know, this wunderkind
24.
Yeah, this wunderkind lens designer that they've got off in the corner is like, I guess I'll sit this one out. But
I think they wanted to make something small, which they did.
It makes sense. Yeah. For the it's A7C light, series, yeah.
It's small. I could absolutely see it being a, you know, kind of useful lens for like an event photographer on a budget. You know, you maybe don't have the money for a 24-70 G Master version.
But isn't this actually kind of expensive?
It's not cheap. Like, I believe $1,100, which is very close to the 20 to 70, which was that lens of the year or runner-up?
I think I chose it as lens of the year for me anyways.
Yeah. And even if you, let's say you decided to go not first party, there are other options from Tamron too, right? That are probably more performant and cheaper.
That's what I'm saying. It's a lens for people who maybe don't want to spend $2,500 on a G Master, which I totally understand, but they still have that desire for a 2.8 lens. But yeah, I do think the 20-70 f/4, even though you lose a stop of light, is infinitely more useful. Or you have lenses like the 28-75 Tamron G2, which is a great lens. Yes, it's not 24 mil, but it does give you far more reach. It's only 100 grams heavier, so it's not like it's appreciably heavier, right? Like, and it's brilliant optically. Yeah.
The other one that we get brought up all the time is the Tamron 20-40, which is bizarre. It is the only lens of theirs from the last like 6 years that we never got sent a review copy.
20-40?
So that's bizarre.
Yeah.
The 20-40. So maybe I need to just pop by the camera store, shoot a chart just so we know how to compare it to other things, because that does seem to be like a pretty popular lens.
Weird for that you didn't get one. Right, I can probably get you one. I mean,
yeah, we could probably
friends
get
with
one
Tamron.
Too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But 24-50, not a bad lens at all.
Not a bad lens. Not a great lens. It's just in the middle.
It just doesn't I don't know where it fits, and I feel like it's a very competitive field where it does try to fit, and there's lots of other options. So the consumer really has to do their due diligence and really look around and make sure that is still the one that you want.
All right. I'm starting to feel pretty good about my bold prediction last year. I don't know about you guys, but I feel strong.
Your Foveon?
My Foveon prediction, because I talked to him about a lot of stuff, Kazuto Yamaki, and he says that Foveon is not coming this year. It's not coming next year. It's not even coming the year after that. We are we are at least 3 years away from seeing the camera. If everything goes perfect from this point forward, there can be no other issues. Like, so for example, let me back up a little bit. That's the story. Sigma's full frame Foveon camera is at least, quote, a few years away. And the reason being is they've been stuck at that same stage that they've been at since 2022.
Yeah.
They found an error in the way that their prototype was rendering. And these prototypes apparently take like 6 months between deliveries. So when they found an error, they had to fix the error. Then they had to send the new spec out. Then it had to get remade. And they haven't even received that prototype yet. They're expecting to get that one in like this summer. They'll have the most recent prototype. So then when that's done, they then have to upscale it to full frame because the prototype's not full frame. It's close.
Right.
So then they have to upscale it, and then they have to find a manufacturing partner, and then they have to actually start mass producing it. So by the end of this, he's like, they still want to do it. They're still trying. But let me read the exact quote. I personally cannot guarantee to go to mass production at this moment, but the engineers are still working hard. I'm in camp of we'll never see it. And I'm okay with that. I think I like that they're still trying. I can approve of that, but I don't see it. Thoughts?
I think it's interesting. If that timeline is correct, it will be a decade between Foveon camera releases.
Okay, between releases, yes. This camera's been in development since 2016.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm often the more optimistic one out of us three when it comes to this stuff. And in this case, I'm actually going to be a pessimist. I mean, like, why do we even need a new Foveon sensor?
At this point.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's not like it was ultra compelling even back when it was a contemporary sensor to the competition. And now it's going to be crazy expensive, very niche. I also feel like in a few years, I mean, maybe we're going to start seeing a lot of organic sensors hitting the market and they're going to bring a whole bunch of advantages. I don't know. Like,
oh, well, that's funny. On that note, I do have an update from that. I haven't written that story yet, but I talked to Panasonic about it. Yeah.
It's, you know,
never,
what I mean, though? It's
ever,
like, it's like if a Foveon arrives in 2 or 3 years, like, will anybody even want it? I mean, it would have to, like,
there are some Japanese
tuck you
fans
in at night. It would have to, like, it would even, have to, like,
even if they
you,
do
give you some ASMR stuff. And
even if they do release it, I feel like Sigma would sell it at a loss. They would never make money on this camera.
Yeah.
After all this time,
yeah. There's just no way. I feel bad for them.
And then I love Sigma, but are they going to put it in a camera which isn't made for human hands? I don't know. I don't know.
Have we discussed on this podcast Kazuto-san's reasoning for continuing camera development?
I feel like
I know we've talked about it off mic.
I should have confirmed that's still the reason when I was talking to him. But go ahead, Jordan. Why does he want to make a camera?
So he made a joke on an interview. I think it was with Imaging Resource, actually, back in the day, that his father always wanted to make cameras, made cameras when he ran the company. And he feels like if he stops camera development, his father will haunt him, which is the best response ever.
But I feel they gave it a college try. I mean, we'll see what happens. I mean, if a company can do it, Sigma can do it. I'm not saying that they don't have the passion.
And they're definitely a company that makes niche things. They make niche stuff all the time. So even if it doesn't, even if they don't sell well, he will at least have fulfilled his duty to make
it. I mean, hey,
his obligation to family.
If you don't want to be haunted, I get it.
Oh, man. All right. Moving on. Panasonic has a tiny, tiny, teeny, itty bitty all-in-one lens. It is a 28 to 200 f4 to 7.1, and it is L-Mount's first all-in-one zoom.
All-in-one zoom.
Yeah, I think Chris probably has it over there right now, right?
I do have it. I have it. And it feels like, I don't know, it feels like 1989 all over again. You know, everybody's going to start making these giant super zooms that are very slow. I mean, the thing, it is compact, and we are testing it. We're going to be doing a review here pretty shortly. I think the aperture is still going to be a thing, right? 7.1 is not fast at the long end. To its credit, I believe that it does push the aperture range scale farther towards. So I guess what I'm saying is you tend to get a little bit more light throughout the mid to normal range than you might normally, but yeah. You know, it's a travel lens, sure. Like it's compact, absolutely. So I'll be making judgments on is it worth it or who's it for, I think is really going to be the main story here.
It's $900 at the end of April, by the way, for anyone listening. Yeah, just curious.
That's not crazy.
What that costs.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's nothing competing with it. That's the thing. You know, in L mount right now, we haven't seen, like, the benchmark is that wonderful Tamron 28 to 200, 28 to 5.6.
But Tamron doesn't make L mount. Tamron pretends it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're in the market for that, it is really nice. The one thing I do want to say is on the thing that we were at that I can't talk about, I brought this lens because it said 28 to 200 macro on it. Perfect. I can get my product shots and stuff like that with it. And it was a great lens to have, you know, nice and compact while I was roaming around. But when we got to the product shots, its best macro is at the wide end at 28, which is very difficult for product photography to light and everything like that. So it actually wasn't an ideal candidate for that. I wound up just shooting it in Super 35 mode to get a little bit tighter and get those glorious shots that you'll all see in the future.
Of something that you can't talk about.
Something that I can't talk about.
Stop
Jeremy.
Talking about it.
Stop pretending that you can talk about it. All right. The next thing we're going to talk about that's not that is the original OM-1 got a firmware update.
Nice.
Hey!
So
we did it, Chris.
We did it. So here's a quote from OM System. Since the announcement of the OM System OM-1 Mark II interchangeable lens camera on January 30th, there have been many inquiries regarding the possibility of a firmware update to the OM System OM-1 released in March 2022. As a result, we would like to advise of our plan for a future firmware update for OM-1. So it's going to improve the autofocus and That's deliver nice. Improved operability by allowing users to assign the trash button as a menu access shortcut.
Yeah, so some of the stuff that we said specifically,
I don't know
think
you said
this
that.
Could be addressed in.
That
I don't think I touched on the right
on the
hand
trash
button.
Yeah,
right.
Oh, incompetent. Who's going to take the fall for this, Chris? You or me?
It's my fault. It was too busy talking about the 48 other features that added that, you know, our video would have been 86 minutes long.
So yeah, what did you say in your review of the OM-1 Mark II that you thought could have actually been a firmware update? It was the autofocus improvement. Was there anything else?
The autofocus is important to talk about because that was probably one of the more compelling benefits that I saw in the OM-1 Mark II. Because the OM system and Olympus, really, the tracking up to this point has been lackluster, 100%. So the OM-1 Mark II really improved their tracking performance. And so I would love to see that come to as many of their other cameras as possible, because I think that's a big tangible benefit. Other stuff is, there's a lot of stuff that could potentially be firmware improved. So I don't know, I guess we'll have to see if this firmware update does that. Some video features they added were basically firmware updates already. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I think Chris is right. When he did that thing, he was like, the autofocus alone might be grounds for updating. Now, they did say you're not going to get identical performance with the OM-1 with the new firmware compared to the OM-1 Mark II because it does have that extra RAM in it. But if it's close, then that's great news. That's going to be a massive update for people who, like I said on a previous podcast, you know, stuck their neck out and invested in a camera company that's very new to the market. And I think those people should be rewarded by getting, you know, as much in software as the hardware can deliver.
One last note on this. We kind of talked a little bit about this in previous podcasts about how OM System is the spinoff from Olympus that is owned by Japan Industrial Partners, who is also known for doing the same from Sony and Vio. Mm-hmm. I saw a Vio laptop while I was in Japan, by the way. It was wild. I asked them, OM System in Japan, I asked them, so like, how involved is JIP, Japan Industrial Partners, in like your day-to-day? And they're like, for like the first year, they're pretty involved. I think they wanted to know like their investment. They are pretty hands-off now. They basically are like, you guys are doing a good job, which tells me that OM System is profitable, that they are actually, you know, not requiring the financial overlords looming. So they said they meet with them about once a month now, which is not bad at all. That sounds like just like a check-in. And so OM Systems doing fine as far as I can tell. And as far as JIP can tell, they're doing fine. So that's good to know. All right. Last thing. Do you guys think Sigma should make medium format lenses?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, so does Kazuto. Kazuto also thinks they should do that.
Because he's really, really smart and awesome and a great interview and just a charismatic delight.
Yeah, that's basically the whole story. He said that I'm personally very much interested in supporting medium format. It's a small market, but I have some interest. Up until now, we've been very busy to have a range of lenses for full frame mirrorless. So we have to have some of the regular stuff like a 24-70, 2.8, a 35-1.4, 50-1.4. But now that we have these lenses, that's why they started releasing unique products like the 500, 5.6 and the 15-1.4. So now we can expand the roadmap, he said. So some people took this to believe that they've finished doing stuff, like they've done all that they can for full frames and now they can focus elsewhere. That's not what he's saying. He's saying that he's done the stuff that, like, you know, people demand they must have, and now that they have it, now he can, like, now they can play, they can do some other stuff. So I would expect them to keep making stuff for full frame mirrorless.
That's because we have a Foveon medium format camera coming out from Sigma in 15 years. It's going to be incredible.
Oh my god, medium format. No.
I loved your question there in the article, just like, well, you're the boss. Can't you just make them make medium format lenses? Like,
tell them to do it?
He's like, yeah, I guess I could. But yeah, he needs to evaluate the market, basically. But like, come on. Come on, Kazuto. You made a 15mm f1.4 fisheye. You're going to sell infinitely more anything you make for the GFX than you would for that. I wonder how
protective the manufacturers would be, though, the medium format companies.
Like, that's the other thing I was about to say.
They make some expensive lenses, like Hasselblad. They don't want Sigma lenses.
No, I doubt it would be for Hasselblad. It would probably be for Fujifilm.
Because it would need a leaf shutter as well if it goes hassy. We haven't seen an autofocus. There's lots of third-party GFX lenses. I don't think we've seen an autofocus one yet.
They would have to come to an agreement with Fujifilm.
So they're probably buttoned up against that. Yeah.
Can you imagine if Sigma came out with like three nice leaf shutter primes for GFX tomorrow? They would make a killing.
Oh, man. Every GFX shooter, just give them a functioning leaf shutter lens.
Yeah. Fujifilm. Why is Fujifilm that'd be amazing. Not being a leaf shutter?
It's madness. They're throwing away such a big chunk of the market.
Anyways.
On that note, that's it. That was the week.
I mean, that was CP Plus.
I say that's it like that was nothing. That was a lot. There's
a lot.
More to
come. So much cool gear.
I did interviews with Canon, and as a preview for that, we talked about the Apple Vision Pro with Canon. We also talked about third-party optics. We did lots of stuff, and I have more to share, but that will come down the line. Also, I talked to Panasonic, and they have some stuff to share, too. So it'll be a couple more weeks of stories that we can get out that CP Plus has granted us. So that was fun.
Here's what I want to know, Jaron. So what is the vibe you got talking to all those people? Because the impression that I'm getting is 2024 is going to be a huge year in like the photo video space. Are you getting that impression as well?
At least from some of them. Canon is very, they play things pretty close to the, is it to the chest or to the vest? I'm never really sure
It's to the chest. Yeah. Okay, you can play poker and not wear a vest. Okay. So.
They play things close. They were surprisingly candid about a couple of things once we asked, but that was the most formal interview I have ever been in. It was wild. So when you asked me how I thought those people acted, like, or how it went, like we ran the gamut of people. We had Kazuto in his gray suit. He just like bounds into the room and he sits down by himself and just having a conversation. Then there's the OM guy in a t-shirt. Then there's the Lumix dudes, were two dudes I'd never met before, young guys also in just like super casual clothes, just hanging out. Then there's Canon, where it's the most business formal thing ever, where they had an official translator and some dude with a stopwatch on time next to me, and then like three attendants off to the side and name tags in front of them. It was very formal. I felt like I couldn't breathe without asking for permission.
They have the little memory erase thing from Men in Black, like ready to go in case someone says something not supposed to. Yeah.
But I did get a sense that all of them are feeling good. Like all of them are like, this is a fun time to be in the industry. Like, except for Canon, who didn't actually express a lot of fun.
Express fun.
Yeah. They just expressed existence and
Canon
they're doing stuff.
Doesn't do fun.
We're still here.
It's just very corporate. Japanese corporate.
That's always been that way though. Canon's always been that way. Yeah.
So, but yeah, I would say that this year should be very exciting, which is crazy because last year was extremely exciting too. Like last
year,
did
you play with the Apple Vision Pro?
There wasn't one there. We talk to Canon about their thoughts on it. And
because I can't wait to try one out and just like sit on my toilet, but project myself like in a tropical jungle with all the sounds.
He's been talking about this
while
a lot.
Having a conversation with my AI girlfriend. I can't wait.
So I propose they're giving the, like, Jeremy's already done it. They're doing those like demos at Apple stores. I propose all three of us go in the near future, maybe for next week's podcast. And I want us all to have ideas.
But will they let me take one to the toilet?
No, they won't.
No, they won't, Chris.
Well, then I don't want to go.
Oh my God.
Does Apple even have toilets? They don't have garbage cans. We learned that when we
they have a tender.
Very unattractive. all right. So what have we been up to? Well, you all know what I've been doing. I was in Japan last week.
I want three highlights of Japan.
I did not see natto anywhere. I was very disappointed.
What? Not on the breakfast? Usually like on the breakfast.
So we were staying at the new Otani Hotel, and they have four places to have breakfast. And I'm sure you guys have stayed there if you've been to a Fuji.
Yeah, they put you in the new Otani again? That's a beautiful hotel. By the way, Japanese garden's gorgeous.
That hotel, I don't think they have a functioning like individualized air conditioner for each room.
Right.
The tower is the temperature that the tower is, and whatever you set your fan to in your room, that's just
a
lie.
That's what you get.
At any rate, there's four places to eat. All four of them had very similar things, but they like shifted some stuff. But natto was nowhere to be found on any of the menus, so I was very disappointed. Oh, but you wanted highlights, Jordan?
Yeah, three.
One highlight was that bowl of maguro, the tuna that I told you about earlier.
Oh, the death row tuna.
The second one was doing very unusual cocktails with Richard. Richard took me to this cocktail bar in Ginza. The menu is a fruit basket. So you point to a fruit and he'll make you a cocktail based on that fruit. And I asked him how many in his mind does he have for each fruit? And he's like, oh, tons.
Endless.
Endless. Yeah, he can keep going. Last one. I'll have to think a little bit more about another.
Go to a secondhand anime store in Akihabara like we did, where you could look at secondhand hentai. You didn't do that?
That's super weird that you did that. No, I didn't. I did go to a special, so it's called Tamashi Nations, which was a show floor for Gundam and Gunpla. So I got to see a bunch of scenes from my favorite Gundam, which is Gundam Seed, because they're doing a thing for that now for the movie. That showed like a bunch of scenes reenacted in Gunpla, and I thought that was great. I have like a little booklet I got there, a special edition book that shows like all the stuff for the anyway. It was great. So that would be my third thing. I got to do that. And I went there with Richard, who was uninterested.
That's past and future guest, Richard Butler from DP Review, who rules.
Yeah.
My highlight was getting Jordan to say Genshin Impact.
In Japan?
Yes.
Can you say that,
It took Jordan? A lot of coaching. Genshin Impact 2.
Okay, nah, it's not a 2, it's just 2.
He's out of practice. He's out of practice.
I think this is what Chris was correcting me on as well at that point. I assumed it was a sequel.
All right, what have you guys been up to? You said you had something, Jordan.
I got something. So I went snowboarding with my kid the other day. Haven't been in years. Had an absolute blast. I am now completely broken shell of a man after that, because I had a crash for the first time in a really long time. So I was going down, my kid and I, like side by side. He's a great skier now, so we're just like, he's keeping up with me, we're having a great time, and I'm throwing him under the bus here. This kid swerves right in front of me. I try to stop. I'm on a snowboard, he's on skis. Huge collapse. I land on my wrist, bang my head really hard, all that. And this woman comes up and she's like, oh my God, that was horrible. Are you okay? And I said like, I think so. And she's like, I'm talking to the child.
Your own child.
Yeah. Which, you know, I know what he looks like when he's really hurt. So I was like, oh, he's just a little startled, but we're fine here. But yeah, in that moment, I probably came off, and she didn't even know I was his dad yet at that point. So that's even a worse, example of parenting.
Wow, Jordan.
Anyways, had a great time. I'm going to try and go more often. I think I'm going to go pick up a snowboard too and get back into that, because I really enjoyed it. Had a great time.
That's good.
The other thing I want to quickly touch on that I think really pertinent for photography fans listening to this, is my buddy Bayrod, who's actually, he was on our old TCS live show reviewing the A9 as a on-set photographer camera. But dear friend of mine, he's been like an AD on movies I've done. He launched a new podcast called Crisis and Victory, where he's talking to people in or adjacent to the healthcare industry about like their experiences and things, which is, yeah, it's a very interesting podcast. But the reason I bring it up here is he just had our friend Leah Hennell, who is one of my absolute favorite photographers in Canada, on to talk about her experience. She went from photojournalism to working for Alberta Health Services right before the pandemic hit. And she has released a book called Alone Together. That's like a,
yeah, it's a great,
really book. Incredible, like black and white documentation. The access she had is unbelievable. And you've, Jaren, you've seen a bunch of her pictures. Very famous one of like a doctor kneeling with his head in his hands, calling family and stuff like that. Absolutely incredible work. So she went on there and they didn't talk, you know, I listen to a lot of photography interviews, but so much of it's like, you know, gear or photographic technique. And this is really interesting in that they talk a lot about like ethics and things like that of it. Like, have there been times where you've had the camera up to your eye and you've chosen not to shoot the shutter and stuff like that? Just an excellent and really insightful interview. So yeah, it's called Crisis and Victory is the podcast. Listen to the Leah Hennell episode. And I grabbed one of her books, Along the Western Front, I have right here, which is kind of like outside of, you know, the farm living around Alberta here. I wasn't able to find Alone Together because we keep, when people come over, we're like, look at this damn book. This thing's amazing. So I don't know where it is in our house right now. But yeah, check that out as well. Definitely give it a listen. And I mean, these are both dear friends of mine. So I'm a little biased, but I thought it was great. So that is my plug for this week.
Cool. Nice. Chris, are you
I'll be quick then. I did a volleyball tournament. Well, my kid's volleyball tournament. I had to sit through that.
Yeah, I want to see you do a volleyball tournament.
Yeah, I would. I couldn't do it. But that was what I did for the weekend. And my wife and I are on an Alexander Payne kick right now.
Yes. We'll
talk about that more soon. But I just wanted, you know, so Michael the Maven, Michael Andrews, he makes these filters. Jordan and I both used them, and I don't talk about them enough. So I thought I would talk about them because I just got the new 72 mils that he sent. These are magnetic adapted. 72 mil is going to go on my OM-1 2 and EM-1 Mark III on that beautiful 12-100. And what I like about this, it's so quick to click on and off. No screwing, just click on, click off. And it's a 3-stop plus circular polarizer. So I'm excited to use that for the fishing stuff. Not so useful for our show, but certainly for the fishing stuff. And that's about it. Nothing else really exciting.
I love those filters as well.
Yeah,
I was really happy to see some fresh ones after just decimating them in Idaho when those were attached
if you're looking for
spraying gravel and like nothing could survive that.
So, if you're looking for clear filters, like neutral color filters that are well made and very easy to take on and off, it's a really nice, very simple system. I like it a lot.
Before we move on to tech support, Chris, are you going to watch Shogun? I think it's available now.
I absolutely want to watch Shogun so bad. Yes,
okay,
absolutely.
I'm going to probably watch it this week. You should watch it this week
too. Is it starting now?
Yeah, I just saw it when I turned this TV on to put the fireplace on. It's like it said Hulu's streaming now. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to watch that.
Oh, yeah, I want to watch Shogun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, you know, like that reminds me. What have I been watching? I mean, Masters of the Air, it's all right. Formula One, Drive to Survive, back season 6. I'm a poser completely when it comes to Formula One. But I do love this show. Like, I watch it. It's so good. It's actually very compelling to watch, even if you don't really care about racing. And that's been great. So I'm working through that.
I watched all of Trigun Stampede.
That is
it's an anime.
Animation. It's an
anime. Oh, thank you.
Series, yeah. Just so you know. Yeah.
All right. Tech support time.
Right. We got lots.
We do have a lot. So we may not get through all these this week. That's fine because the backlog is not as heavy as it used to be. So the first one is from Jay on Spotify. What is ISO invariance for the first question? And the second question is, and how weather resistant are modern mirrorless bodies? Camera companies just say weather sealed in quotes on their website, but there's no evidence for that claim.
Yeah.
Why don't you do
ISO? No through line between those two questions whatsoever.
Do ISO invariance first, and then the second one I have some input on.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, so ISO invariance is pretty simple. I mean, I guess to keep, well, it's not simple. It's actually quite complicated, but to keep it simple... To keep it simple, sensors used to basically bake in ISO. Like, if you shot at a higher ISO, you're going to bake in a certain amount of noise.
It was increasing the amplification of the sensor.
Yeah, introducing you're boosting noise. The amplification of the sensor, right? Adding more noise, and that's basically permanent. With an ISO invariant sensor, the idea is that you don't have to do that at the time of shooting. You don't have to bake it in. What you can do is you can leave the sensor at its base native ISO. And then, although the exposure is going to be quite dark, if you go in post afterwards, you can amplify it in post and you'll get basically the exact same image quality as if you had raised the ISO in the first place. The benefit being that by not raising the amplification at the time of shooting, first off, you can protect your highlights a lot better, right? Because when you amplify ISO, you amplify shadows, midtones, and highlights. If you don't amplify those things, the highlights can stay well protected, and then you can just bring up the shadows and midtones afterwards. That's a huge advantage. Also, just the advantage that you don't have to make a permanent decision at the time of shooting. You can do it afterwards. That being said, not many people still choose to shoot that way. I think most people still tend to shoot the classic way of matching their ISO for the exposure needs. But yeah, that's a very simplistic way of saying it.
I want to do a whole podcast about how manufacturers could make it optimized so you can take advantage of that highlight information, and they choose not to.
Or give you
they make
preview?
It very difficult to like perfectly expose your image.
Okay, hold on. Before we forget, I'll put it on the board right now. Podcast, April 3rd is the next available podcast for a new topic. ISO invariance.
Oh, yeah. If anybody has a hard time sleeping, I would tune into that one. It's
gonna help. That's going to be a real popular episode that everyone is going to listen to, start to finish.
Weather sealing is a really big one because you're right. This, you know, Jay, this is kind of the Wild West.
You asked like if there's a standard. That's the neat part. No, there's not.
Yeah, sometimes manufacturers will throw in an IPX rating, which is great because that does have...
That's a real rating.
It's a real rating. But often you'll just hear people say things like dust resistant, moisture resistant,
and then with an asterisk that says not guaranteed to actually resist all dust or water.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and what kind of dust, right? I mean, the dust that we experienced in Idaho on the McCall trails is so fine and deadly to camera gear, it can get in anywhere. Whereas, you know, the dust around your house or whatever, who cares? So yeah, it is the Wild West. There aren't any standards really. And right now people can basically just say, like, you could put in a piece of foam, closed cell foam, inside the barrel and say, oh, dust sealed. Right? Like it's the Wild West.
On this note, actually, right before I left Imaging Resource, Dave Etchells, the guy who used to run Imaging Resource, who founded it, had decided to try and actually do this. Yeah. He wanted to actually provide a real rating that standardized what everyone else was doing that wasn't IP, because IP was too much. Like, it would, none of them would qualify except OM stuff. So he had built this machine that would drip water onto stuff that he could actually determine at what point it seeped in.
And like spray and all that kind of
thing. Like a lot of these will basically are just protecting against rain. So he was just saying like how much rain? How much rain?
I've never found the like spraying a jet that useful, because that's not a scenario that comes up to me that often.
It's like, I mean, it depends sprayed what kind with of jet. Photography
there are
you
drops
do.
Of water coming from, that's a valid argument, Chris.
Some and videography, hadn't really there's some spraying that. Involved. Yeah.
At any rate, no, there's no standardization. So when someone claims it's weather resistant, I mean, look at them like the DiCaprio meme from Inception.
Like, I think definitely like we need to put some pressure, because there are a few like Leica and OM are putting actual IP ratings on lenses and bodies, and we need to really start pushing.
We should give a higher
direction.
Thumbs up to anyone who is actually
draw more attention to it.
I think we have to some degree. We've always talked up Olympus and OM system. We've always talked up Pentax, who did a really good job.
Yeah.
We even used to torture test some Pentaxes back in the day. And Sony's lenses, their G Master series, have come a long way. But again, but it's like they're very well sealed. I mean,
yeah, but how well? There's not enough to get an IPX or an IP rating.
I don't know, dude. Like, you know, on our Idaho trip, we had some professional lenses. We don't need to really talk about the brands right now, that had some issues that
we already
you
have
know,
previously.
High end. And we had some G Masters, which absolutely survived unscathed to that dust. So I was pretty impressed by that.
There's one key thing you're missing there is that one of those lenses was generally pointed forwards towards the gravel spraying into it. The other one was pointed backwards where there was much less of a small rock.
But they got covered in that
everything
fine particular.
Everything was zoomed and focused.
Like they got used.
I will again reference the picture of the three of us where Jordan looks like Mel Gibson.
We are not. Us three are not.
I know it's extra at work, but for the people watching the podcast, Jaren's going to put that picture.
Oh, here. Am I? I'm going to go find the Mel Gibson picture.
You're going to go find it. Yeah.
All right.
Oh, it's Yawning Marmot again. Let's go to Yawning Marmot.
Yeah, Yawning Marmot is back here again. This is from YouTube. Tech support question. How does Jordan white balance his shots when shooting the episodes of your show? Do you eyeball it or use a gray card X-Rite color passport? Thank you in advance.
So the big thing there is auto white balance is my best friend when I'm doing photography. It's very easy to change in post if it's off and you don't have to stress about it that much. Terrible thing for video because you'll have color shifting mid shot if you use auto white balance. So my general solution when I'm looking at this, most of the time I'm in sun, cloud, shade, or tungsten. So I'll use those defaults for it. And if I'm a little bit off, you know, I can generally push at 500 Kelvin one way or the other. There are certainly times like recently Chris and I were shooting beside like a bright orange light with a dark blue bridge right behind it. And in those cases, I will just manually dial in the Kelvin color temperature and even the tint sometimes.
Yeah.
Using the EVF, do not use the LCD because the ambient light is going to screw up your perception of that as well. Yeah. And I'll dial it in that way. I had three X-Rite color checkers, all gone. No idea where those things went. They were great for testing lenses. I didn't find I actually used them that much for white balance because the log formats, they're so flexible now.
I was going to say,
I can fix it.
You've gotten a lot better at eyeballing. Well, you always have been, but you've gotten much better. You eyeball everything. I do have an X-Rite color passport. I choose not to bring it because Jordan has lost three of them already. So No, Jordan doesn't get to touch it, and it's good that he's able to eyeball it anyway, so we're good.
I remember meeting with X-Rite, and they said, like, how many would you like? And I was like, I don't know, three. There's no way I'll ever burn through those. Joke's on me. Lost. Sorry, I cut you off there, Jared.
No, I used to, I still, when I shoot video, I'll eyeball it, and I will use the manual Kelvin thing. So I think Panasonic has one where you could actually see like the color chart. I can't remember what that's called. I would use that and set it because I used to do interviews and we would be sitting. So my light would not change. And also I was not really sure about the exact color temperature that I was getting. So I would dial it in by hand, but I would not use a card. Like some sort of heathen, I guess. all right. We're going to listen to a speak pipe. This one is from Hessel Folkertsma. Let's listen in.
Hi, Petapixelites. My question is regarding dynamic range in relation to sensor size. So I've heard multiple times that medium format cameras will deliver better DR and color information. But keeping all things equal, like sensor technology and the size of the photo sites, should there even be a difference? Thanks again, and until next time.
So this is another complicated one, and it's complicated because there's so many different wafers on the market. Age of the sensor is going to play a big part too.
But what if they're the same? He's saying all things equal.
Yes, all things equal. And that does happen. I mean, there's a lot of situations where medium format sensors essentially built up from multiple full frame sensors next to each other.
Or APS-C.
Yes, or APS-C. So the thing I would say there, Hessel, the thing to remember is although you might have the exact same wafer, there's still a lot going in the background. Big thing is going to be you're going to have more megapixels because a physically larger sensor built up of more actual area, you're going to have more megapixels. And when you have more megapixels, we've talked about this quite a bit, noise is often in relation to how you're going to display it, right? The actual end result of it. If I have more megapixels, if I do smaller displays, smaller prints, each individual pixel is smaller, the noise is individually smaller, and so the appearance of it is smaller, right? So that plays a big part in it as well. There's so much going on in the back end. Like we talked about, well, like I talked about with F1 cars, you know, all these sensors are basically doing the same thing. They're driving a track, but what everybody does tweaking the back end and small little changes in the processing engine and where they choose to, you know, start the base ISO and how they deal with shadow noise. There's so many different techniques and approaches that honestly, I mean, we don't even know all of them. I mean, there's a lot of engineering going involved there that you can get quite different results, even though the actual hardware is very similar.
I think the biggest thing to keep in mind, again, saying all things being equal, is you have more total surface area. I mean, the image quality just comes down to how much light you can soak up. The more, the better. If you have a larger surface area for that light to go onto, you are going to get more information on it, which means less noise. And when we talk about dynamic range, I mean, highlights clip when they clip. It's all how much can you bring up those shadows. If you collect more light, you can bring those shadows up with less penalty. And that is really what it's all about. As we go, not just full frame to medium format,
no,
every sensor size as we step up.
Yeah. That being said, you know, you did talk about medium format cameras. I mean, medium format cameras will often do 16-bit RAW. We don't find that to be that big an advantage over 14-bit, which a lot of other cameras will do. And also, you know, sometimes medium format cameras, the dynamic boost is there, but it's like 2/3 of a stop. You know, it's not always like this huge, huge change. So I feel like full frame is really kind of the sweet spot right now for where a lot of the engineering goes, the manufacturing, you know, the effort. And so full frame, I think, still give you a really good combination of excellent dynamic range without having to go to a larger camera.
All right. Next one is an email from Matthew Bynowski. I'm a Nikon shooter looking to acquire a general purpose lens for Z mount. I already have the 105mm macro lens and 600mm telephoto. For more, quote, normal photography than macro or birds in flight, four choices make some sense to me. 28-75 f2.8, 24-70 f4, 24-120 f4, and 24-70 f2.8. With the exception of the latter, all of them are more or less the same cost. All possible is ducking the whole issue by continuing to use my 28-300 f mount on its D750, which is, for him, $0. A quick inspection of Nikon's published MTF curves for all of them do not show any huge differences in performance, but that's only lab data. You folks are really likely to have actual use experience with all five choices. Which would you choose and why?
Yeah. We do have experience with all these lenses, and they're all good lenses. I guess, you know, the 24-70 f4 is a great kit lens. We've talked about how it is nice optically. I feel like if you were to buy that with a camera where you get the kit price, it makes a lot of sense. I don't know that I would invest in it on its own afterwards, because you have lenses like the 24-120 f4, which would probably be my vote, only because, like, that lens optically is very good. I mean, it's at the point where every shot I get with it, I'm like, I like that shot. I'm happy with it. It's got good detail. It's nice. There's no nasty surprises.
Is that the one we were using in Idaho?
That is the one we're using in Idaho.
Yeah, that was shockingly good at everything.
Absolutely. And so, you know, it's versatile. You're still getting an F4 aperture. I would probably personally go that way. The 24-70 f2.8 obviously is going to be very expensive, and that is a killer lens if you feel you need the extra light, but most people don't.
Yeah, I think the 28-75 is an interesting one if you want that 2.8 aperture. That's a great portrait lens as well. But my preference would still be the 24-120. Having processed Chris's shots from Idaho, I'm like, this lens is so good. Really, and good. I mean, I know we've tested the two, and the 24-70 at 70 is a little bit sharper in the corners, but having that extra 50mm of reach, I think, offsets that.
I recommend you go watch that video if you haven't. I'm sure you've watched already. If you're listening to the podcast, you've definitely watched their video about Hobo. Go look at the pictures, because we have some on Petapixel too, like where he wrote his story about it, or where I wrote his story about it. There we go. I wrote the story and I used his pictures. You can actually see the quality of those images, and they're all just really good. The food ones in particular are just like,
And I largely relied on just that 24-120.
Yeah, I feel like that was all you had on there. So,
We should talk future pin it in. We should do an Idaho episode as well, because that came out while we were on hiatus. There's a lot to talk
about.
No,
it came out while you had to take care of a sick child. You missed your opportunity.
Oh, that's right. That did it. But you guys didn't talk about Idaho all that.
No, because you weren't here to bring to all the discussion.
At some point, we should talk about Idaho. Right. That'd be fun.
It would have all just been just complaining about not getting the fish. So you wouldn't want to be there anyways.
Yeah, never enough fishing for you. Yeah. All right, we're going to do a couple more. This one is from Joaquin Stenad. This is an email. It was a really long email, so I have just kind of compressed it. My wife needs a video-centric camera to document her project to refurbish an old dollhouse, make new furniture and indoor decorations for it, etc. It will probably be published on YouTube as a DIY project, maybe some ASMR content with the sound of sanding wood, cutting little things, etc. What question is, what camera would you buy for this purpose? And they were already considering the Sony ZV-1.
Yes.
So is that their budget? is between $300 and $700. So it's not very much.
I was going to say, I like Panasonic Micro Four Thirds for that.
A used one is what they said. They could find a used for $300 to $700.
Absolutely. Like a GH5 or GH4 or something like that. Just because you can get some really nice lenses that give you magnification for what you're doing. Because it sounds like you'd want to have nice
GH5 would be good.
Compact.
Well, the GH... So for a slightly higher price, the GH5 makes a ton of sense because you can get it on a super cheap kit with the 1260 Leica.
Oh, I also think you can find it
which
used.
Which is one of my... Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Which is... That was my product photography lens for the last 7 years, I think. It's an outstanding close-up performer. But yes, the ZV-1 is a really nice option as well, and I would get the ZV-1, not the Mark II. I don't think that extra wide angle is going to be as useful for you, and you can get a little bit closer with the 24 to 70 millimeter lens.
I don't remember its macro capability. It was okay.
It's quite good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not as good as the 1260 on a GH5. But again, that's going to be a bit of a premium there. I'd guess you're looking like $1,200 to get a GH with that lens used right now.
I feel like you could get it for less if you looked hard. But yeah, it's, yeah.
Well, I'm not giving you mine.
All right. This is another speak pipe from Jeremy. Let's listen in.
Hello, Chris, Jordan, and Jaren. This is Jeremy, and I'm struggling to feel inspired by my local area to go out and shoot. How do you get over the feeling that everything you want to photograph is somewhere else? How do I find the beautiful and the interesting in an area that isn't?
What do you think about this, guys? Like, because you make Calgary look really interesting.
Do we? I don't know. I mean
the
it's
simple
tough.
Response is go to Idaho, right? Isn't that?
Not brought to you by Visit Idaho.
We've been shooting in Calgary for over a decade, and it is absolutely hard to make it, you know, even remotely interesting sometimes. And we do visit a lot of the same locations and stuff. I mean, the only thing I would say, Jeremy, is that the most important thing to remember in photography, I think, anyways, location is interesting, sure. And we're lucky that we get to travel to other locations, and that does keep us sane. But it's really light. I mean, light is everything. So regardless of where you live, what you really should be doing is trying to chase interesting light or finding places where the light is interesting, whether that be in interior buildings or, you know, just the way light hits your downtown area and reflects off things. You know, that's what you're really supposed to be hunting for because that's where the interest is. If you're not hunting for light, yeah, then you are just shooting the same locations over and over in dull conditions and you'll get very similar results. And then the only thing you could really hope for is, you know, shooting people, for example, because they tend to change from day to day and do different things from day to day. Animals, wildlife.
Don't chase the same one person every time you go out. They'll get uncomfortable at a certain point.
Good luck in jail. But yeah, it's it is a challenge. Absolutely. And if you can get out and travel even a little bit, that can be helpful, but it depends where you live. I mean, in Canada, you could drive 10 hours and it's basically the same stuff. So, you know, I get it. We do often travel, down to the South, Jordan, like, you know, maybe small town stuff or Drumheller, you know, we look for different landscapes, but really it's the light. It's the light that you got to hunt for.
One recommendation I would really give is I've had a lot of fun either putting a restriction on myself when I go out to shoot, like, hey, I'm just bringing one prime out with me, like a 35 millimeter, a wonderful focal length.
The best, really.
Lets you create, a really wide variety of things. Or like I have had a great experience going out to places I've shot a million times, I'm so bored with like an ultra wide. I know I did that recently with a Laowa, a super wide lens, or a super telephoto, a focal length I don't use a lot. Yeah. So, you know, even just rent something for a day, it's not that expensive to do. And I find that can be really satisfying to just look at places you've seen all the time with a completely different perspective.
You know, another thing you do is you can look at other photographers and see how, you know, I mean, everybody sees the world differently. And that's a really big part of how life looks interesting. And there's a person I follow on Instagram, Tammy Trashbags, and they shoot in Bristol, which is not a huge town. Yeah, Tammy Trashbags, they shoot in Bristol. And the way they see the world is unbelievably beautiful. And, you know, they're looking for light, they're looking for interesting color, but also just having that sort of eye of where you position things in the composition. And so every time I look at their photographs, I'm always blown away by, you know, it's the same town, it's very similar subject matter, but always enjoyable to look at. So, yeah.
Someone who... Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I have, like, I grew up on a farm in southern Alberta, and I don't see the Alberta country the way that Leah does in this book that I actually love looking at, where if I go to a farm in Alberta, I'll be, like, immediately, like, bummed
out.
Get
me out of here.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that's a perfect point, Chris.
What I was going to say is I had a similar situation come up where I looked at someone else's work and it inspired me to go see, because I knew what they were seeing and they saw something different than me, because we saw the, like, it was right. During the trip in Japan. His name is Casey. His YouTube channel is GX Ace, and he just does the coolest looking videos. He does it from the perspective of, like, someone looking at this time from the future. So, like, everything is,
oh, cool.
It's like his idea is message from the future, I think. And the way that he edits his pictures and the way that he sees light, Chris, is was very inspiring. I will link him in the description below, because his channel is dope AF. And I think he is an incredible creator. And his video about the X106 made me want to go shoot more with a camera.
And I already wanted fired. To shoot.
We should get him on the pod.
I can ask him if he'd be interested in getting on the pod. Yeah. All right. Last one of the tech support, and then we'll bang through the three never read the comments. But okay. The first one is from Nicholas. It's a speak pipe, so let's listen in.
Hi. With the recent phone reviews, I'm wondering how manufacturers decide what a times 0.6 or a times 5 telephoto even are. How do the zoom factors you see on smartphones relate to focal length or field of view? Thanks.
It's completely arbitrary.
Yep.
No, I just, no, it's not actually.
No, it's not. It's actually very, it's surprisingly simple. Yeah, it's surprisingly simple. Yeah.
Go ahead.
You're basically,
it's simple. Take our word for it. Moving on to the next question.
It's just, they're basically just multiplying the focal length of the main camera, right? To get all the other cameras. So whatever your main camera focal length is, five times that, for example, would then be the focal length equivalent, right? Of your main camera five times. So for your telephoto. And then your ultra wide, they'll often do like 0.6 times, right? So it's just a fraction of the focal length of that main camera. So that's where the numbers aren't arbitrary, but they do it in such a way because it I guess it's easier to digest, you know, the difference between a Samsung having a 10 times zoom versus an Apple iPhone having a 5 times zoom, right? Rather than give in photographic terms, what we tend to do is say, well, I've got a 24 mil lens and then my telephoto is a 120 millimeter lens or whatever. So
I think it's really interesting that we use a different thing for smartphones than compact cameras, which would always be from your widest lens. Like, I remember Kodak even brought out a camera with two lenses. It was an ultra wide and then a 3x zoom lens, and they called it a 5x zoom because they were basing it on the ultra wide, which we don't do with smartphones. Because like an Apple with a 5x zoom, you could say like it's got an ultra wide, it's actually a 10x zoom compared to that ultra wide, but they don't do that. So everything's weird now.
Yeah. It's not that weird. It's fairly straightforward.
I'm calling it weird. I'm going on record with weird.
But that's, and you know what, of course, because the sensors are so tiny on smartphones, the true focal length numbers will often be in very strange, minuscule numbers compared to what we're used to, right? I mean, lenses will be 5mm and 7mm and stuff, like, you know, not the double digits we're used to in most cameras. But the concept is the same. They'll usually give a full frame equivalent, you know, 24mm wide angle, 25mm wide angle. Your telephotos will typically 120, somewhere in that range or more. And so that's how it relates to focal length or field of view. We convert everything to full frame field of view. Then we have some concept of how it's going to look compared to another camera, even though half the time you're shooting your phone vertically, not horizontally. I mean, smartphones are a mess. Damn you, smartphones. Damn you, straight to hell.
Okay.
Can we make that a shirt, Jared?
Damn you, smartphones. Yes. Damn you, straight to hell. Tech support, that's it for the week. We're going to move on to Never Read the Comments, the section where we make sure to always read your comments. And boy, reading your comments was a lot this week because there were a lot of comments. This one's actually a leftover from last week that we didn't get a chance to get to, and I wanted to get Jordan here on it. But it's from T on YouTube. Hey, Jaren, Jordan, Chris, I really love your videos. Do you have any tips on how to pick photos? What I mean, I'm a hobbyist photographer, and one of the biggest problems is I always end up with a bunch of images, and I can't seem to choose only a couple of them, although most of them are really similar. I just find something in each and convince myself I need to keep it. The problem, however, is later when I look back at them, like a couple of months later, I get lost in the plethora of images. Help. Well, T, you could do what Chris does, which
horrified me, but he'll just pick one or two, one from a set. He'll pick one, and then I watch him delete everything else. He holds on to nothing.
Nothing.
And it's just like, oh my God, but what if, nope, gone, no. Deleted. He's like, nope, don't worry about it, delete. It is, I don't know, I can't do it, but both him and Jordan does it with video too. As soon as he's done editing a video, he's like, delete, gone, see you later.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, I mean, we're putting through so much content. I mean, first off, just logistically, it would be a nightmare, but also, I don't know, it's kind of like, I like to put things out of sight that way. Like, you know, I don't want to have to feel like, oh, I'm missing something, and if I've deleted, it's gone, right? My wife is simply like you, Jaren. She cannot delete anything. Like, the just, and I get
what if
it,
I need
it's
it?
Like the anxiety of like, oh, what did I get rid of, right?
Yeah, what if I need
the
later?
USB cable of images? Yeah.
Yes, like, I had a drawer of USB cables that I finally got rid of because they were like micro USB to
You're
like
gonna
mini.
Need one in a couple months. You'll see.
I'm going to need that FireWire cable. I swear to God.
I did eventually get rid of my FireWires.
Dude. But I mean, you know, I like to shoot. First off, I'm quite selective now in my old age before taking a photo. There's a lot of times where I'll raise the camera and then I'll be like, oh, it's gross. It's garbage. It's the worst photo ever. I say this to Jordan all the time. And so I'll ignore it. So I'm quite selective about what I even take a picture of in the first place. Then often I like to shoot bursts a lot. And that's more from really just trying to make sure that I have something sharp and in focus, especially if I'm pushing things to slower shutter speeds and stuff. So I tend to do bursts. And that means when I'm in the sequence afterwards, I don't want to keep all of them, right? I'll generally start from the rear because I feel like I've probably made the best decisions towards the end of that where I say, oh, maybe I should use a different aperture. Maybe I should do this. And I'll work my way back looking through the photos. But a lot of them are just going to be sequential repeats. So I'm basically looking for, is it in focus? You know, is it sharp? Great. Okay, that's the one I'll go for. No point looking at the others. You know, they're not going to be any better. And then, yeah, get rid of them. Get rid of them. Yeah. I feel like if you hold on to a lot of photos, look back at them later, there is some, I don't know if you should take photos where you look at them right away and then look at them later. I feel like that's a recipe for disaster. You're just going to drive yourself crazy. But I think there is some merit into taking photos, putting them aside, and then looking at them weeks later or months later where you're not biased by the experience you had when you were shooting. But of course, we don't have that luxury in our business. So it's very quick, shoot, look, evaluate, throw away, and don't worry about it.
Yeah, why?
Yeah, speaking for myself, like I have gotten much more ruthless through the years. I will, if I'm shooting like a family event or something like that, I'm like, you know, one sequence of kid on boat, good, done. I make that decision, everything. Like, I think you have to do that. Because even scrolling through like old photos on my phone and something like that, it gets tedious and it keeps you from actually seeing the best image if you have a bunch of different options. So I want to make that decision in the moment, save myself future stress. So I know, hey, this picture of kid on boat is the best of the pictures of kid on boat. And I'm looking at it right now and it's great.
I choose a lot of these photos, though. I think it's important to say because, you know, I think the question also is, how do you pick which ones you like from all the photos that you've taken? And
sharpness, and obviously, that's the only metric by which photography should ever be judged, Chris.
Yeah, see, and I hate that. That's how it used to be, and I don't want to do that anymore. So I honestly go by feel. I go by, like, do I get a response? Does something hold me and grab me? That's my main indicator for then, okay, I should look at this photo more. And if I'm comparing similar photos, I really just go by which one speaks to me a little bit more than the other one does, even if they're very similar.
All right. I just keep everything because I'm a maniac and I have apparently endless storage. I tell myself that I keep it later and I haven't run out of storage yet. All right. Last ones are two for Jordan. We're going to end it on this. Alfonso Herrera Mora asked, said, I wish Jordan would shoot more with the X-H2S. That camera looks gorgeous. And John Shockey responded in response to that, I'm wondering what lens he used. So Jordan, please talk about why you apparently hate the X-H2S and don't want to use
it. I love the X-H2S.
And then what lens were you using?
So first of all, I mean, it's the X-H2S has a great sensor, but it comes back to Eterna is my favorite, like 709, like a profile where you can just shoot it, slap it online and it's going to look pretty good. I just find it has wonderful colors, really nice contrast. I don't have to do much work to it at all. So that is absolutely, if I'm just going to shoot and share, that's my favorite profile currently available. Like Panasonic's like 709 is my favorite on their bodies, but I do find it has a little more of a video look than the Eterna. F-Log 2 as well, their new F-Log profile is gorgeous and grades incredibly well. So for that episode, just depending on the contrast, all things being equal, I prefer to shoot an Eterna. Less work for me if it's all going to fit in the waveform, because Fujifilm is now putting waveforms in their cameras. But if there's a lot of contrast, switch over to F-Log. And I love that Fujifilm has a LUT, which is generally they'll give you like log to 709, a standard color space. Fujifilm makes an actual log to Eterna profile. So if you want a similar contrast curve, but want to make sure that you hang on to a little more DR, that's a great way to work as well. So yes, I love those cameras. I've said repeatedly, they're some of my favorites for shooting videos. The limitation is glass. They don't make a lot of video centric lenses, with the exception of they have MK series manual focus lenses. That's what I reviewed the XH2S on initially. They're spectacular, but I don't have $5,000 per focal length kicking around to use those all the time. But stunning lenses. The one that I used to shoot that, the camera store had a 16-55 available, which is just a great f2.8 standard zoom. A little bit limited, though, in terms of it does breathe quite a bit.
Yeah.
It does have a focus clutch, but the focus clutch is backwards from what a regular video lens would be. So it always slows me down a little teensy bit. Go ahead.
So I wish Jordan would shoot more with the XH2S. And the reason you don't is lenses?
That's a big part of it. Yeah. I look at the glass that I want to shoot on before I pick a camera body. Like a recent trip that we took. You know, I knew I wanted that 28-2 travel zoom, you know, before I chose a body for it. So that is a big priority for me. If I get a set of MK cinema video lenses, then yeah, man, I'm grabbing an XH2S all the time. It's a great around? Video body.
Come on. Would you want to carry those around?
Yeah, they're great. I'll suck it up.
No, you won't.
Maybe one.
Your bag is already so heavy, dude.
Like, I mean, Panasonic do a great job of making lenses that work well for video. And I think that has to be
especially for the style of shooting we do. Yeah. Absolutely.
That has to be appreciated. Yeah.
But yes, I love the image from the Fuji films. I'm always thrilled when I get them into editing and start playing with them. I just find those files look great.
All right. Cool. That's it. That's the podcast.
That's it.
Yep. That's just nice. That's all I got.
It was nice to be back.
Oh, I bet Jaren's so happy right
I'm
now.
So
just
happy.
Holding that perfect.
I am. Look at it. It's just so good.
It's just creativity in a small little box. Yeah. It's unbelievable.
It's a camera. Light goes in it. And
the X100 6, for anyone just listening, I'm just now holding it up. I'm looking through the viewfinder. Anyway.
Just furiously trolling Chris. So,
Thanks, everyone, for tuning in this week. Thanks to our podcast sponsor, OM System, again, for sponsoring the episode. It was great to see all three of us here again, finally. It's been a while, been a few weeks. We're back on schedule, though, and we'll see you all next week, where we'll have a guest. Who it is,
what?
You'll find out next time. Tune in next week. See you then. Bye.
Bye.